I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Our guest is comedian Hari Kondabolu, whose humor tackles race and social and political issues. His debut album that came out last year is Waiting for 2042. That's the date when whites are predicted to become 49% of the U.S. population. He's been praised for his style of political comedy. In fact, he can make a joke out of colonialism. Here's a clip from a show he did in Australia earlier this year.
Apparently, Australia is so far from the rest of the planet that you're really strict about not bringing in fruit or plants into your country because you're worried if foreign bodies enter Australia, they'll kill people and destroy the environment. Which is a very fair point, because if you ask the Aboriginals, they would tell you that sometimes foreign bodies enter Australia, kill people, destroy the environment. For those of you who didn't know, the theme of my set tonight will be colonialism. Which is why I will be speaking only in English.
Hari Kondabolu worked as an immigrant rights organizer in Seattle. In fact, received his master's in human rights at the London School of Economics before becoming a stand-up comic. He's appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and had his own Comedy Central special. He's in Philadelphia to perform at the Helium Comedy Club for three nights starting tonight. And he joins us on Radio Times to discuss his comedy, his life, and why he's waiting for 2042. And Hari Kondabolu, nice to have you with us
on
Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Do you like listening to yourself? I always like to watch people listen to something that they've recorded earlier.
Normally I do, because I'm an egomaniac like every other comedian, but I had a cold during that particular performance, so I can hear like me sounding more nasally than usual, which is a very bizarre thing to think about. I'm like, I wish I didn't have a cold.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was fun to tell that joke in Australia, obviously.
And you got some laughs.
I got some laughs. I mean, I got some looks, too. Like, what is he doing right now? Why is he doing this? But it worked at the end.
So. You know, reading about you, I mean, it did look like you were on your way to be some kind of a lawyer, maybe a human rights lawyer or an immigrant rights lawyer. What happened?
Well, law was out just because I was an organizer, an immigrant rights organizer, and I'd work with lawyers, and lawyers would tell me, do not become a lawyer. Like, you have a nice personality. It's such a waste. And I'm like, this is probably a sign. But I did want to be an immigrant rights organizer. I wanted to either work on policy or organize on the ground or create a linkage. I got a human rights master's because I wanted a human rights framework to the immigrant rights organizing I was doing. I had a different life plan before comedy kind of happened. I was living in Seattle as an organizer, and I did comedy at night, and comedy took off, and it wasn't my plan. Like, it's something I love to do, but I didn't think anybody else wanted to really hear what I had to say around the country, and I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, and the next thing I know, it's a real thing.
But what's so interesting, in my mind, there's nothing more serious than human rights or even immigration rights. I mean, that seems like almost like a deadly serious thing to be involved in.
Sure.
Did you feel like you were living a kind of a schizophrenic life?
A little bit, but a little bit just because the days were so different than the nights. Like, you're working with people who are victims of hate crimes or whose family members are being deported, or you go to a detention center. Like, I'd go to the detention center in Tacoma and meet people, and it was really intense. And then at night, you know, I was trying to make people laugh, and sometimes about this stuff that not quite exactly. Like, I was in the detention center earlier today, but I'd find a way to, like, weave in the things I was seeing in my life in a way that was accessible to people. But it was a little strange. But, I mean, the thing is, in some ways it's not, because humor is a coping mechanism. It's a defense mechanism. It's a way to survive. So if I was seeing all that stuff in the day, of course I have to react somehow. And since I did comedy, it was the perfect way to react.
As I was putting my questions together, I was thinking about Donald Trump. We were actually talking about him before going on the air. I remember Stephen Colbert saying, you know, I hope Donald Trump, you know, lasts until the beginning of my show. And I'm assuming for comedians, that's a lot to work with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and, you know, you obviously have a background in immigrant rights.
Yes.
It's bad for the country.
Oh, yeah. I think as a comedian, this is a gold mine. Like, I'm very excited about what I'm going to write. But as a human being that's worried about other human beings, I'm very worried about it. I mean, partly because, like, the rhetoric that he's using is mainstreaming hate, right? And for years I've been frustrated about, like, Pat Buchanan, a figure like that, who talks about white people, you know, being victims of diversity and things like that. And this is a white country, a Christian country, and kind of narrowly defining what is a really diverse country. And Donald Trump does that in a way that for some reason he's allowed to do it. He's forgiven for doing it. It's almost like people haven't adjusted to the fact that he's a presidential candidate and not a pop figure who can say whatever they want. Like there's no accountability for Donald Trump. And when you're mainstreaming things like there was a story of two Trump supporters committing a hate crime against a Latino man. And I think the only thing Trump said is that his followers are passionate. And we're not going to hold him to that. You know, it's so much racism, and whether or not, like, you think he's going to win or not, it's kind of irrelevant if he wins or not because he's already done a lot of damage.
Well, and I think looking at audiences that seem to like him, they find him very funny.
Yeah, because he's a straight shooter. He says what he feels, but he doesn't have a great deal of depth. And I don't see him really explaining his points of views. And he uses simple language. I mean, kind of the way Sarah Palin did in the previous election, except it comes off as even tougher because he says, you're fired. Well, what's the reason a person's fired? It doesn't matter because I say you're fired. Mm. Like, he makes decisions, but I don't know what his reasoning is behind those decisions. I mean, he'll fix the economy because he's a successful business person. He's also been bankrupt and had to come back. And also, what is he, real estate? That's not the same thing as an economy and the complicated parts of a country. And it's sad because it almost feels like Mike Judge's Idiocracy, a film that was made a few years ago, just about the idea of, like, you know, who's going to get elected by the end? And it's going to be probably pop figures. And we no longer are paying attention to anything. And we've all dumbed ourselves down. And I never thought it could be this bad this quick. But really? Donald Trump, I mean, that is an absurd thing to even consider.
Well, he was asked about how he would build this 1,900-mile wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And he said, well, I build buildings. I put up buildings in New York. We can do this.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's not the idea about building a wall. It's like, is it good to build a wall? What does it mean to build a wall? And also the fact that, like, Mexican immigration to the U.S. has been something that has been a key part of this country, both culturally as well as, like, you know, the Bracero program, in the last century, where people would regularly go back and forth as seasonal workers. And the border was very porous. And, between, like, the war on drugs and also, like, changing feelings about immigration, this has become something that people are questioning. But we didn't question it for years. That was part of it. It was a very porous border. People would go back and forth and work, and culture would go back and forth. And it's funny how we're allowing everything to be globalized except human beings.
So how do you turn this into something funny?
Oh, right now it's not.
That's why I ask. I see how frustrated and angry you are.
I mean,
are.
Sometimes you get lucky and you have, whether it's a political figure or a personal experience where someone says the most ridiculous thing where you can show the hypocrisy and the double standard that they're using. Like I do this joke just about how I hear people say Mexicans are lazy, but Mexicans also steal all the jobs. And how can those two things possibly work together? And I think something like that, it's something that people can relate to in the sense that, yeah, I've heard this and this. I'm not getting deep into policy, but I'm also talking about the fact that you can have both things. It's ridiculous to say both things, and you know that's not the case. It's kind of cognitive dissonance.
Is that how you work? I mean, just in terms of putting together – not necessarily jokes, but even a whole show. Is it kind of looking at the disconnect in stories and news stories?
That's a lot of it. It's not the only thing. I mean, there's a lot of personal experiences. Or right. When I like talking about colonialism or bigger concept kind of things. You know, I think I'm topical in the sense that I'm talking about things that a lot of people care about. But I don't necessarily think about news stories. Like Rachel Dolezal was a goldmine for me because it's talking about what is race, right? And who gets to define race? And also, it's such an absurd story, the idea of someone could fake being black for that long and become the head of the NAACP. So it has something ridiculous, but underlying that, there's a lot of assumptions and thoughts about race that I can dig into. Race as a construct, how she was exploring it. It's fun in that way.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get lucky and you have something that could trigger something or at least bring – that's why elections are good, I suppose, because it brings all these – big things I care about to the forefront because candidates have to talk about it, so it becomes part of a national dialogue. And for me, I'm talking about this all the time anyway, so when it's part of the national dialogue, people are more tuned in than they normally would be.
This seems like a great time for political comedy. Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of material to work with.
Yes.
And you think of, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, you, Larry Wilmore. I mean, they're just
I appreciate you putting me in that company, Marty.
Well, you had a special on Comedy Central.
That's true, yeah.
But does it feel like, I mean, and I guess it's both a comedy and a tragedy to things that are going on.
I mean, it's the fact that things I care about greatly are being mainstreamed, like the Black Lives Matter movement. It's not like police brutality is new. It's not that like cops killing black people is a new idea. It's just that now that we have the internet to expose it, now that everyone has the ability to record and share information quickly, there's tons of evidence. It's all over us. And the mainstream media reacts to what's happening on the internet. Like, you tweet something, it could be news. Maybe it's laziness. Maybe it's also the way our culture is now. But as much as it frustrates me sometimes, you know, when I see random tweets from people I don't know on CNN, it also allows for people to create change locally by being able to film and document what they're seeing and finally have proof. I think so much the unfortunate thing about race is how white privilege works, where you say this is happening to me and someone says, well, I don't see it, so it's not real. That's not my experience. And how could it be your experience? But now it's being documented. It's forcing people to question what their reality is, what reality is in general in this country. And so that becomes news. And so everyone's talking about it. So even if you can't talk about, like, well, that's not my experience with race, you can at least talk about, I saw that video too. It becomes more narrow. It becomes more specific. I've seen tons of videos. I see what you're saying about that. And that allows like a comedian or anybody who's talking about these issues to have a common point to get into a topic, which before you're going to have people that would immediately be like, I don't want to talk about it, I don't agree. Well, now you can talk about it because we all saw the thing. We all saw it together.
We were talking about this, about the fact that you still go to colleges. Some comedians are saying, I'm just not going to go there anymore because they don't laugh at my jokes or everything has to be politically correct. Has that been your experience?
It has not been my experience. And I feel like when Jerry Seinfeld says it, it's like it's the old guard saying it. Jerry Seinfeld's not playing colleges anymore. He's made his money. He can play wherever he wants to play. And at this point, his audience, you know, isn't necessarily that demographic either. You know, Seinfeld's been off the air a long time. You know, it's not to say he's not super famous, but it's not like that his experience is going to be different. But I think it's our job. Like, I don't like the idea of political correctness because I feel like it shuts down arguments, right? It doesn't actually – the term itself, because it doesn't actually address a person's point. When people, you know, can't play colleges or they feel people are too sensitive, the question would be like, these are 18 to 21-year-olds. They're the future of this country and they're the future market, if we're going to talk about in business terms, for comedy. If they're not laughing at these things, we have to figure out how to make them laugh, because that's our job as comedians, is to figure out what people laugh at and find interesting. And if they don't find this interesting or funny or they squirm at it, I wonder why and I wonder how I can reach them. That's what you're supposed to do as a comedian. You can't be lazy and say, well, I don't want to think of political correctness. That doesn't actually solve the thing, which is how do you make people laugh? So it frustrates me because I think it's lazy, and it also really underestimates people's reasoning and their logic and why they make the choices they make. And clearly these kids, they're not stupid. You know, they're being educated in a way perhaps we weren't educated at the same time. I want to know what they know.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with comedian Hari Kondabolu. And he is here in Philadelphia for three nights at the Helium Comedy Club tonight, tomorrow night, and Saturday night. Two performances on Friday and on Saturday. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And I do want to play a clip from his new comedy album. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is comedian Hari Kondabolu. He's a New York-based comedian, made a name for himself addressing race and race relations, politics, even nerd culture, and joins us on Radio Times to talk a bit about his life, comedy, why he's waiting for the year 2042. His debut album is titled Waiting for 2042. And I do want to play another clip. This is our guest performing live at Chicago's Lincoln Hall, July of 2013. Let's give it a listen.
People always say I'm obsessed with race. You're obsessed with race. You're obsessed with racism. You can't be obsessed with race in America. This racist stuff that happens all the time. You can't be saying that I'm obsessed with race and racism in America is like saying I'm obsessed with swimming when I'm drowning. You know what I mean? It's absurd. I'm not the one who's obsessed. This country is obsessed. I hear about the year 2042 all the time on the news. 2042, for those of you who don't know, 2042, apparently, according to census figures, is the year that white people will be the minority in this country, right? White people will be 49% in 2042. And I don't know if there are people in this audience that are upset by this, but don't worry, white people. You were the minority when you came to this country. things seem to have worked out for you, right? But here's the bigger point. Here's the more important point. 49% doesn't make you the minority, right? That's not how math works, right? 49% white only makes you the minority if you think the other 51% are exactly the same. That only works if you think, well, it's 49% white people and 51% you people. That's the only way. Because that 51%, my friends, is not a united front, okay? Just ask a black guy and a Korean guy what happens when the black guy walks into the Korean guy's store, okay? I bet you that interaction isn't pleasant. I bet you that interaction isn't like, hey, teammate. How's it going, teammate? Pretty good, am I right? 2042. You know, that's not what's happening. It's not what's happening. It's not a united front. There is some historic tension there. And some of you might be thinking, well, you're saying that 51% is not exactly the same, but you're assuming that all white people are the same. Yes. No. No. I'm joking. I'm obviously joking, right? Why am I joking? Because white isn't a thing. Race isn't a thing. It's all made up. It's a social construct. It's a way to separate us and destroy us, right? It's not real. White isn't a thing, and we know this, right? There used to be signs in New York that said, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. The Irish weren't white. The Polish weren't white. The Italians weren't white. The Jews weren't white. It's made up. It's a way to separate us. And you know, is there people of color in this room? You know, when you ask your white friends what their cultural heritage is, they never just say white. No, they give you a math equation. I'm a third German and a fourth Irish and 1/16th Welsh. It's like, damn, Steve, all these years I thought you were just white. My bad. I should have been more sensitive.
That's our guest, Harry Gundabolu, performing live at Chicago's Lincoln Hall, July 2013, and his debut album called Waiting for 2042. I really like that. I think it shows how you construct the humor underlying it with all sorts of, you know, important social and even research issues.
Thank you.
I mean, the race is a social construct.
Right. I mean, that also speaks to my overeducation.
And that's right.
I write my jokes like little essays, and I look for punchlines as, you know, the way to prove my point. But, yeah, I mean, I'm all about explaining things you know, even if someone doesn't get a reference to go back and explain, which you're never supposed to do. You're never supposed to explain your jokes, but I like explaining my jokes. I feel like that in itself allows for the form to expand. I like the playing with the form of stand-up comedy. And if you can, I can go back and do, because if you're told not to, then I'm like, why can't you not do a thing? So let's see how that works. So creatively, it works great. And also, I mean, that's obviously stuff I care very much about. And that had been frustrating me for a really long time, especially the idea of like, we're treating whiteness like a thing that's a really clear, singular thing, and we're pitting everybody else as others. And that's the clearest example. And why is this a news story?
Yeah.
What kind of hysteria are we trying to create?
Yeah.
And I've thought a lot about the fact that I grew up in Queens, New York, which is the most diverse place in the world. And whenever people talk about the future, they're basically talking about it turning into Queens. And I love Queens. And I loved growing up there and having the world in front of me. Why do I need to vacation when the world is every neighborhood, right? Like, why do I, you know, I'm prepared. This idea of diversity wasn't a thing I knew. I didn't know what that word meant until college, and it became something that was commodified. Like, but day to day, I lived it, and it was beautiful. Food was great. I mean, like, there was meeting different cultures. I mean, I don't know what we're afraid of, because to me, when we talk about America, that was America to me before I started traveling. Like, that was America to me. It was Queens, and it was beautiful.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's our guest, Harry Gundabolu, and in Philadelphia for a couple of performances at Helium Comedy Club tonight, tomorrow night, two performances, and Saturday night, two performances as well. And he's joining us on Radio Time to talk a bit about his comedy. I do want to talk about his life and playing some clips from some of his performances. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Your parents are from India.
Yeah, Southern India.
Southern India, and part of an arranged marriage. And I know, you know, in this country, people get asked about arranged marriages all the time, as if it's something just so unusual. Your father came here first, as I understand.
Yeah, he came here in the late 70s.
Why did he come to the U.S.? What was here for him?
Well, his sister had come first, and she slowly brought her family with her, you know, her siblings. And so my dad, I think he saw opportunity. He mm-hmm. saw a change, and he was curious. He spent, I think, a year in Louisiana, which I only recently found out.
Doing what?
I don't know exactly. I think he was working down there, and he eventually moved to New York. He said it was just very strange, just like he told me once that somebody approached him and asked him if he was Chinese because they'd never seen anybody look like him before. They'd say, "Do you know Dr. Rao?" and the other Indian person, and he would because there was only like a handful. Of course he did, but to me it was like, why would they ask him? Like, oh, I guess that would make sense. Of course he would. And then he moved to New York. He's a echocardiogram technician. He works in a hospital, but you know, it was kind of a, you know, a lot of those early stories in days with my mom and dad that they tell me about, a lot of them are immigrants helping other immigrants. And it's not just immigrants, like other Indian immigrants. Like the first place they lived, a guy named Mr. Bornstein, he was a Polish Jewish guy, like older man, like he got them free furniture. He looked out for them. He made sure that we had stuff. He always got toys for us. Like, you know, when my mom first came here, she met a man at a library, and you know, he told her about the history of the United States, and they used to go out for coffee after mm-hmm. they go to the library. When my dad worked at a Duane Reade drugstore, like the folks who worked there who were also immigrants would let him come in and study on his shift and hire an extra person to do my dad's shift. And when, you know, they question, why is Ravi not working? Like, he's studying. You just do your job. Like,
nice.
It was just the sense of, and that's why, again, when I think about when people are worried about this country and the future, I'm like, that's beautiful. That's people like helping other people and creating opportunities for them and really believing this idea of an American dream, which, you know, of course is, you know, hyperbolic and is kind of exaggerated and is not completely fair and true. But if you really believe in those ideas, why are you worried about like people coming here not supporting that mission?
And your mom is a doctor. I mean, she was trained as a doctor in India.
She was trained as a doctor in India, had her own practice in the late 70s, got married, and that kind of all disappeared. But like certainly –
she gave it up?
I mean, it was hard. You know, you come to the U.S., you're learning another country, you have kids, and you know, she never really got back on that track, which is heartbreaking and frustrating because she was a woman in southern India in the 70s with her own practice in her hometown. Like
seems almost unheard of.
Yes, it's shocking. She went to, you know, medical school very young. Like she's a brilliant woman, you know, so funny. Like I certainly get a lot of that from her. Like her sense of humor is incredible. And I mean, I think you have to when you're surviving, when you're dealing with so much pain and disappointment, like you have to find a way to keep it together. And she taught us that, me and my brother that, and she's, you know, to me still, and maybe it's corny to say, but she's my hero, and I'm so proud of her. But like, you know, it hurts to think about like that's what you have to lose.
She literally could not practice in this country.
You have to retake everything, and I think it's hard. You have two kids, and you can't afford babysitters. I mean, you have to make it work, and I think it's hard to raise two kids and study for exams. And at a certain point, it's like this isn't happening. I got to find another job to help support these kids, and so. You know, immigrants give up so much. Like, that's one example, but they all give up so much. They give up their families. They give up their lives. They give up their culture. They give up their language. They give up so much to come to a place. And as I've seen, you know, I've traveled through India more than my parents have. They've never really traveled. They basically stay in their home state, you know? Like, I've gotten to tour around the world. I've gotten to see more than they've ever seen. Like, that's shocking to me.
Yeah. You know, when you think about arranged marriages, I mean, you can think about so marrying someone that you don't know. I mean, there's that piece of it. But it also tells us something tells us something about family.
Yeah.
That these two – that family chose and arranged for these two people to live together, have children together, maybe even, you know, grow old together. Just the power of that decision.
I mean, and certainly it's not like every case is the best case, and it's not like arranged marriage looks the same depending, you know, depend the class and caste, and there's all sorts of different factors that go into how it looks and time period, you know what I mean? Like the way it looks now to people, I guess, are my equivalents, like I guess middle class, upper class, and in India is basically, you know, a certain type of dating that parents do the introductions and you hang out. If you don't like each other, then you don't go. Yeah. Just there's some parental link to it. And back then, like, my folks hadn't met. Like, their first date was the wedding. So it wasn't like they didn't even, know each other very well. And, you know, certainly they've had bumps. But, like, you know, they've grown into love and grown as a couple. And it's a very different way of looking at things.
Yeah.
And it's not to say there's tons of terrible cases. But the same thing is true with marriage here, you know. And people always say, well, the divorce rate, arranged marriage is so low. But that has to do with family pressures as well and all that. But I think both the institution of marriage here and the institution of marriage are very different, very complicated, has its issues. I think people see it as, well, you know, we gave away these farm animals for your firstborn child a generation down the line. It's not like that. Like, it doesn't need to look like that. So, you know, it was, for me, it was strange to be like a lovesick teenager and have parents who didn't have the exact same experience. Or the idea of dating wasn't a thing. And for us, it was a bit of a disconnect. And it was something I never really wanted. But it is interesting. Right. I've learned to respect it in different ways as I've gotten older.
Did they want – you have a brother. I mean,
younger brother, yeah.
Did they – I mean, was the – like many immigrants, education really important? I mean, you went to the London School of Economics, I'm sure in part because your parents wanted you to get a good education, or did that come from you?
I think a little bit of both. I think part of it is like they wanted me to go to law school. Well, they wanted me to go to medical school. But then when they noticed as a teenager, whenever I saw blood, I would get squeamish and pass out. I passed out. My dad was getting blood taken from him in my mom's hospital. The whole thing was very embarrassing. So I think they scratched that off and they thought maybe lawyer. And I went to Seattle and I took the LSAT. But again, I was telling you that everyone was like, no, don't do that. It's not really my strength either. Like, I like to be around people. I like to talk. I mean, I think either policy
lawyers
or,
like to talk, but
it's
under,
different
in a courtroom.
And that kind of
different.
Writing, also legal writing, which is still to me is a ridiculous thing. Like Latin, really? Really? That's how we're going to hide information from people? We're going to put it in Latin, a dead language? Really? Nice. Nice move. But I knew that law wasn't going to be it. And I think the human rights masters was something like, again, would give me this framework for immigrant rights organizing, and was an incredible opportunity to meet people from all around the world who were passionate about this. And for my folks, I mean, I think I slowly lowered the bar. Like, I'm going to be a lawyer. Oh, no, I changed. I'm going to go get this master's. Oh, I'm going to be a comedian. By the time you keep going down, they're like, all right.
Whatever,
yeah,
right?
I didn't start with lawyer to comedian. There was that in-between step, because human rights and comedy, equally lucrative.
Yes, although one has, I guess, a mass, you know, some letters after.
Right.
But are they cool with you? Are they okay with you being a comedian?
Very supportive. I mean, of course, it's the same worries I think a lot of parents have. Do you have health care? Are you going to be okay? Like, do you have savings? Do you think about retirement? Like, these are things that maybe other people have, like, things set up through work, and I have to do it, and I have to get my own health insurance, and there are no guarantees. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my timeline is different because I'm touring, I'm traveling all the time. So it's not like all my friends are settling down and having kids. Like, my timeline looks different. So all that stuff gives them terrible anxiety. But I also know that they're incredibly proud. Like, they were in the audience when I did Letterman. They go to a lot of my big shows. Like, it means a lot. And my dad Googles me everywhere I go. So he'll hear this interview and he'll correct me if there's anything factually wrong about the stories I've told, as will my mom. But, I mean, I think they're proud. I mean, it's a strange thing. My brother used to be in a rap group, and he was on Conan at first, actually. And so it's kind of funny to be like, oh, we have two kids who've done these really weird things, and both of them have been on Conan. So, you know, that's funny. It's a part of our life that we've accepted. I'm sure their friends are very confused, and people at home, meaning India, probably have no idea what's going on with
their kids. And Ashok is your brother.
And my younger brother, yeah.
And you've worked with him, the Untitled Kondabolu Brothers Project.
Yeah, we do. You know, we do them less often now since I've been touring a ton, but we do a lot of like live shows with a poorly constructed PowerPoint, but allows us to like basically.
Is there any other kind?
Right. I mean, we like to keep the production values, though. I think it adds to the humor. But I think part of it, I think people love it just because the dynamic between two siblings is pretty universal. And when we bicker, it's pretty like shared. Even if people don't know what we're bickering about, they like how we like go back and forth. And we're very different people. Like I'm very much, and I realize I'm a stand-up comedian, but I'm a square, you know. And I'm very kind of, I'm a little uptight, and I'm definitely an older brother. And my brother is not those things. And you know, when my brother wears things, other people wear the thing he's wearing. You know, nobody's
one of those people.
Yeah,
wow.
No one's gonna want to dress. I dress like a cool professor, but so it's a different kind of thing. So, I mean, I think that dynamic is really fun for people. And he's also smarter than I am. I think I have more book learning, but in terms of a formal education. But my brother is, He's brilliant, and I think people really love that dynamic.
When did you start doing stand-up?
I was 17.
17, so you were what, in high school?
In high school. I started a comedy night in my high school, and I did it there, and I thought, I got it out of my system. I went to college in Maine, had to cope with moving from Queens.
Bowdoin, right?
Bowdoin College, fine university, fine college. Franklin Pierce, the 14th president, went there, as we called him at Bowdoin, the finest president. I spent time there. I think dealing with that shift from Queens to Maine, that's abrupt.
I think that is.
Stand-up gave me a way to stand out on my own without not just the looks of, oh, you're not from, where are you from? What's going on? Like pigment. So it let me choose how I wanted to present myself in addition to loving it. And so I continued and I moved to Seattle in 2005 and that was my first real scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
What were your early routines?
Oh,
do you remember?
Yeah, they were terrible. Early on, it was a lot of stereotypical stuff, accents, jokes about my parents. I mean, I don't even do a good Indian accent. It's never. It's like I'm doing an impression of Apu, basically. Like that's how bad it. Which
the
is
Simpsons Apu,
which
right?
is a white guy's impression of an Indian person. Which is really probably based on Peter Sellers' impression from years ago. So I really don't have. I'm not even good at that skill. But I would do whatever it took to make people laugh. And I think that's what a lot of comedians do. I understand, especially when you're a young comedian, silence is the scariest thing. Learning to deal with silence to set up something is a skill. You have to be used to that. But I wasn't like anybody else. And if this worked, why wouldn't I use it? It took years for me to really think about who I was as a person, what I valued, and have role models who did that, whether it was Paul Mooney or Richard Pryor or my favorite comedian currently, the British comedian Stuart Lee, Chris Rock, Chappelle Margaret, people who were challenging and doing things that were interesting and not what you expected. And maybe every show they did wasn't a killer show, but they did what they wanted to do. It took a lot of that before I got to where I am now.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I see some folks want to join us. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with comedian Hari Kondabolu, and he's here in Philadelphia performing at the Helium Comedy Club for the next couple of nights. We'll take a very short break, and I do want to play a couple more clips as well, including a character you created, Manoj Krishnamurthy.
Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Hari Kondabolu. He is a comedian and joins us in this hour of Radio Times talking a bit about comedy, some about his life as well. And he mentioned the fact that early on in high school, he would use an Indian accent as part of his comedy routine, something he doesn't really do anymore. But back in 2009, he was a mockumentary was made about a character that he created, Manoj Krishnamurthy. So let's listen to a very short clip.
We go over to some popular Hindus and Hindons. Eating a sandwich, Hindu, Hindu. Eating a beef sandwich, Hindon't. Having sex after marriage, Hindu. Eating beef, Hindon. Riding in a rickshaw, Hindu. Riding a cow, Hindon. That's beef. That is beef. It's beef. Thank you.
Thank you. Where did Manoj come from?
I mean, he kind of is the perfect enemy. It's exactly what I hate in comedy. And, it was fun doing that voice. Again, I don't think it's a good Indian accent. You could see me slipping in and out of it. But, and I would do that character with friends, never publicly, and kind of goof off on it. And then I thought, why don't I make this character? And I had all these old jokes that it's almost like I want to exercise my demons. Do you know what I mean? So I'm like, let me just give all those old jokes to Manoj to justify the fact they ever existed and were told publicly, because at least then I can give it to this character and I can kind of say this is me also backing off of what I used to do when I was younger. Because the jokes were – I mean, it's not like the jokes were written poorly. They're like fine jokes. They're just not things I want to say. And I'm – and it really kind of raises the question for a comedian, like, what are you going to use your superpowers for?
Interesting.
And because I think making people laugh is a unique thing publicly. It's a skill, and I'm proud of what we do. And that was a question I really asked myself. Well, I still ask myself that. And that to me seemed like a good contrast, me versus this guy. And I put myself in the film, so it's a double role, and it was fun. It was fun to do that, but it also was tricky because people wondered if I would still do that character. I'm like, no. No, because the thing is, when I do that character, I know why people are going to laugh. They're not going to laugh ironically. There's people who laugh at Borat because they think Borat is this brilliant send-up, but they also laugh at Borat because he sounds funny. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's hard, and you can't control exactly why people laugh, but when you can, shouldn't, you know, for me, I'm like, I don't want to do that.
You know, I Googled Manoj just to see, you know, what would come up, yeah. And I got Manoj Kumar, actor. I think he's a Bollywood director.
Huh.
So, I mean, I don't know. I didn't know if there was some, you were making some reference
no,
to him.
No, no. I just thought the name was hilarious. I just thought it flowed really well, and I don't know. I don't know why I picked that name. I just really like that name. But I'm sure if anyone's named Manoj Krishnamurthy in the world, which I'm sure there are, that must be very name. Upsetting to Google yourself.
Are you Hindu? I mean,
yeah.
Are you practicing?
I'm not practicing. I mean, Hinduism is so not formal. You do it, like, depending on where you're from or how you, or, you know, which part of the world and local traditions, whatever. And so I do it the way I do it. Like, I have statues. I keep a prayer string on my wrist at all times, which is funny to see it pop up on TV. I don't think anyone knows what it is, but I know what it is.
Yeah.
And I wake up in the morning after my shower, I'll pray, but it's not like I know any chants or know any prayers or anything I'm supposed to say, but it's a way to meditate and focus. And, you know, I don't know. I want to believe there is a God, and it's hard to think there isn't, just because I think it's for me, you know, I just, as an existential thing, I'm like, there must be something, whatever that is, whether it's a force. I don't think it's a being. I think it's a force. And at least with me praying in the morning, it gives me a way to focus. So I'm not really, I don't know if that's religious or just loosely spiritual. And I found this thing that's a cultural thing that I'm really proud of. This is a part of where I'm from. But, you know, I'm also like political enough where like I make it clear that I don't support the Hindu right wing in India. And that's not something that I'm going to, like, I'm not particularly happy with this particular prime minister and this government. I'm sure I'm going to get something back on Twitter for saying this stuff, because I know what happens when I say stuff like this. But I think, you know, for me, it's, I think religion can be this beautiful, amazing thing. And I know that they'll get something from atheists now and for saying that.
You should be used to this by now.
Oh, I'm already seeing the angles, but I think that things are more complicated. And I think there's so many people who do beautiful things. You know, Martin Luther King was obviously very religious. And I think, you know, you can do some beautiful things with religion, faith.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. 1-888-477-9499. We have Rick from Warminster joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to say how much I enjoy your guest this morning.
Great.
And one of the things that I appreciated was growing up in Brooklyn and then quickly moving to Valley Stream, which is on the border with Rosedale and Queens. And the one thing I've sensed over the years is that you gain by living the same experiences that we've had, kind of a self-reliance and a mutual respect. And I think it may be the fact that you're amongst 12 or 15 million people, but there's a connectivity that you don't find anywhere else in the world except in maybe Queens and Nassau. And I can say, if I was in your studio today, all I've got to say is I know where you're from because you and I have changed trains at Jamaica. That's
yeah.
All you've got to do is tell somebody that. And in a matter of seconds, you are, talk about 3 degrees, you're either going to Far Rockaway in the bar car or you're going to Lake Ronkonkoma.
Yeah.
I have to say, I have no idea what the two of you are talking about.
And I know exactly what he's talking about.
You know exactly what
yes,
I'm talking about.
Yes, yeah.
And it's almost like
special language.
You have just made it so good. And I'm an older gentleman.
Right.
To come from Brooklyn, where parents and live in Valley Stream, where neither parent graduates from high school, to end up as a colonel in the Army, the Pentagon spokesman, and to do the things that you're able to do, that environment gives you a self-reliance.
Yes.
It gives you a mutual respect for others that you have talked about. And it's as common as riding on a subway.
Mutual respect is a survival skill in New York.
Yeah, that's great, Rick. Yeah.
It is the survival skill. And I'll give you a quick one. It was recent. Nothing changes besides changing at Jamaica. You got to go through 3 cars. Marty, you got to run through 3 open-door trains to get to the 4th platform.
I hear you.
And if the door closes, you're going to Lake Ronkonkoma.
Well, I appreciate Rick. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, a kindred spirit of a different generation.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I think that, you know, the language of New York is actually trains. That's the shared thing. We can all talk about transportation. Right. What frustrates us, where we have to go. That is the language of New York more than anything else.
Rick, I appreciate that call, the call to Radio Times.
Great.
And yes, it was great. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You don't have to be from Rockaway or Queens or whatever. We'll take all comers. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Are there certain things you do, Hari, to prepare for a comedy show? I mean, it seems like, you know, it's you, the stage, your thoughts, your humor. There's got to be a lot that goes into just getting in gear.
Yeah, I mean, especially the hours before the show are really important. I don't want there to be – I like being alone. I like to run through my set. I like to think about – because there's also new stuff in there that I mix in with the old stuff. And, you know, I also kind of think of how does this connect to this. And each show, there's an opportunity to do something new and exciting and change it. And so I want to make sure every show, like, I take full advantage of the opportunity to speak in front of an audience, especially, you know, one, you know, a comedy club, you're going to have a guaranteed audience of some sort. So, you know, I definitely, I'm in my head a lot. I like to pace a ton, just review and think about it. And when I'm up there, you know, my hope isn't that it comes out rote and memorized.
I was wondering about that, sort of how much is memorized?
A lot of it's memorized, but I want it to feel different each time. You know, I just, it's like if you know a thing, you can go off script because you can go right back on it when you need to. And my goal is to be so comfortable and be so connected to the audience that I can go off script at any point and connect with them and make sure they know this isn't just this isn't a play. Like, this is something where we're connected. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I'm going to get back to where I'm going to go, but I know you're with me. And so to me, it's important to, like, know your stuff well enough so when you're up there, you can go back to it whenever you want to go back to it if you want to go back to it.
And can you read an audience? I mean, once you go on stage, can you kind of get a sense for – we were talking
Sometimes, before going
on there, it depends how drunk they are to some degree, but sort of just who you're dealing with.
Yeah, audiences always surprise you too.
Do they?
Yeah, like it's like, you know, you go in and you're like, oh, there's a bachelorette party wearing penis necklaces. This might be troubling. And then
Have you seen that?
Oh, enough times where I'm not excited. But at the same time, there are times where afterward the penis party group comes up and like, I love that bit on colonialism. Like, what is going on right now? How did this happen? This is how you're spending your bachelorette party talking to me about colonialism. I'll do a colonialism joke up front sometimes, or a joke that I think is a little harder just to see how they react. And if I feel like people don't know what's going on or
you're groaning,
I'll know like, oh, this might be something where I talk a little bit more about family than I normally do, or try to get us grounded in something where they can connect with me before I go a little harder into the stuff maybe I really wanted to talk about that night.
And have you had nights where it just doesn't work?
Oh, yeah. A lot of nights.
I mean, for whatever reason, it just doesn't work?
There's a wide variety of reasons. The audience is too drunk. I'm off my game, which, not to sound cocky, that's usually not it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, there's a heckler. Sometimes it's a political. The things I'm saying are upsetting people so much that they're interrupting. Or they're just not used to it. They don't know what to say. But I mean, I'm very upfront. Like, my heroes are not people who skirted around the issues. They talk directly about the thing. And I don't really believe in being snarky. I like to hit you over the head with a hammer. I'm earnest, and I own that. And so, you know, some people are not used to that level of directness. And also, I think people read my anger. Some people read my anger on stage as funny, which is the intent, and some people read it as scary. So, like, they don't know how to deal with somebody. You know, it's the brown man yelling at you. He's screaming, and I think it's funny because I love Lewis Black, and Lewis Black screams a lot. And how come I can't scream a lot? So, I mean, I think it varies from audience to audience, but you never know when you have that night that's just magical and you're completely connected to a bunch of strangers.
Well, let me play one more clip that we pulled out, and this is our guest, Hari Kondabolu, at Just for Laughs in Chicago. Just another little taste of what his comedy sounds like. Let's listen.
I've been traveling all over the world the last couple of years. I was doing a show in Denmark last year where I got heckled in a way I'd never been heckled before. A man got up in the middle of my show and he yelled out, "Hey, go back to America!" Which is incredible. because I've been told to go back to so many countries and... never to America. So I've been told to go back to Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. Whatever country we're bombing, I'm told to go back there. at perhaps the least opportune time to go back. It was nice to finally hear America, the country I was born and raised.
And that's our guest from Just for Laughs in Chicago. So, as you say, because you're brown skinned, people think you're from, what, someplace in the Middle East?
Right, or I guess India sometimes. I'm like, you're close, but no, it's Queens. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of assumptions. I mean, when I'd hear questions like that in Queens, it'd be different, right? When people would ask, where are you from? And I would say India, and they would say, you know, wherever country their ancestors are from or where their parents are from. I didn't know white people in Queens. Like, I did, but they would say, no, I'm Irish and Scottish and a little German, or I'm, you know, I'm Greek, even though I've never been to Greece before, or I'm Irish, even though it's been three generations. Like, there's an ownership of your immigrant identity. Like, white? Who's white? We're not from the Midwest. I mean, who's white here? And it was very strange, like, going to school in Maine and traveling, and then when you get the where are you from question, and I guess I answered it, India, after, you know, because I assumed that was how the game was played, and they would say, you know, where are you from? And they'd say, like, Wakefield, Massachusetts. I'm like, no, that's not how you play the game. And then you realize, oh, because I'm the other in this situation. Right. And then when I started saying Queens, like, if that's how we're playing the game, it's like, no, but where are you really from? And after a while, it's like, we're all from here. What are we doing right now? Like, there's no, what are you sensing from me that makes you believe I don't belong here? And that was new. And I know, like, it's not people who are poorly intentioned. It's not like they have bad intentions. It's people that don't understand that immediately you're talking about our differences right off the top as a human being who've connected. We already have this opportunity to find something that's shared. Instead, you're first talking about why I'm different than you. Like, why do I want to keep you around at that point?
I read that you created a hashtag, Bobby Jindal is so white.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
what inspired that hashtag?
Well, I hate Bobby Jindal as an Indian American.
Why do you hate him?
I don't agree with his politics, first of all. I mean, he's against everything I believe. I'm pro-choice and I'm pro-immigrant rights, pro-gay rights, and he's against all those things. And I think the thing that was really targeted at was his assimilationist views. Like, he even recently said that immigration without assimilation equals invasion, right? Which, I mean, are his parents getting deported, like, once he gets elected? Is that how he's going to prove to everybody he means business? I mean, to me, assimilation is finding a way to assimilate into the white mainstream, right? That's different than integration. Integration is beautiful to me. Integration is home to me. That's where a bunch of different cultures come together and create a new whole as a group. And that's beautiful. That's what I want the country to be, is something new that we create together. It's a globalizing world. That's the way it's going to be. And assimilation is pandering. It's finding something for you to accept me, as opposed to let's accept each other. And I hate that. And so when he, you know, him changing his name to Bobby, that is what it is. But him making statements like that is so hurtful to so many people, his views. And to me, if you're going to do that, well, let's raise the ante, and I will start this hashtag, Bobby Jindal is so white. And I did, and I called Asif Manvi and Cal Penn and Hasan Minhaj and the rest of the Indian Illuminati, and we and we went in on it, and it became a story. Because if you tweet enough, it becomes a story on the BBC and NBC and NPR, and I'm appreciative of it. It was good to get that out of my system.
We're almost out of time here. How old? I'm going to be dead, I think, in 2042. How old?
That's
will
terrible.
You,
don't
how,
say it.
How old will you be in 2042?
Let's see here. This requires math,
it
which
does.
If I was good at,
TikTok
I wouldn't be
here.
Doing comedy. Let's see. What year is it now? 2015? 17. 27 years. 27 plus 32. I will be.
9. You'll be 59.
59 years old. Which in comedian years is not likely that I'll be alive, but that's an old comedian, isn't it? But yeah.
I hope not.
I hope not either.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate it.
Hari Kondabolu, our guest. And again, he's in Philadelphia performing at Helium Comedy Club tonight, Saturday night. Tonight, Friday night, and Saturday night. I know the days of the week. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download the podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.